There's something that happens when you start a small business that I didn't anticipate. I knew it was going to be hard and scary and all those like personal things. I didn't know that it was going to be trauma. And I didn't know that it was going to be trauma at the level that it would obscure the trauma that my wife was about to go through in becoming a mother. She felt invisibly pregnant for a long time because I was so in the weeds trying to get the business built that it felt like I'll take care of this and then we'll have a baby. But having a baby is a much longer timeline than when you're having the baby.
Welcome to the Dadwell Podcast. I'm your host, Antonio Garcia. Dadwell & Company is an independent media project at the intersection of creativity and fatherhood. The Dadwell Podcast features makers, artists, musicians, authors, filmmakers, and designers who are raising the creative bar while simultaneously raising small humans. Today, I'm talking creativity and fatherhood with innovation strategist Michael Kaiser. Michael operates in the world of beer and craft beverage. His studio and editorial outlet, Good Beer Hunting, is both the leading voice and instigator in the beer world, analyzing the market, pushing the story, and launching new brands. Michael was named one of Imbibe Magazine's 75 People and Places to Watch in 2015. He has an MFA in poetry from the School of the Art Institute and lives in the Rogers Park neighborhood of Chicago, a city he's called home for 16 years, but still dearly misses the mountains and rivers of central Pennsylvania. Michael is dad to his two sons, ages 5 and 3. In this episode, Michael and I talk about all the places a young man searches for father figures. We talk about the dangers of static thinking as an entrepreneur and how sometimes you have to force yourself to learn the hard things that don't come naturally. He explains how he channels shame and negative self-talk into powerful motivators and what happens when the anguish of entrepreneurship eclipses other life drama. Michael also shares how his boys continuously reframe his notion of abilities and limitations. This is a deeply personal and cathartic episode.
You and I have known each other for some time. You know, we met at Gravity Tank, which feels like a million years ago, but
yeah.
On the same team and did a, you know, some project work together. And so I saw the events leading up to your departure and then pursuit of Good Beer Hunting as more than just a thing you were kind of doing in the nights and weekends. And It's been awesome to watch your work and career and kind of persona take shape. It's been really inspiring and cool to see. And every once in a while, the name Good Beer Hunting or Michael Kaiser comes up in conversation with people. And it's always cool when you're able to go like, oh yeah, I know that guy.
Maybe they know the persona that you just referred to.
Yeah. So definitely want to spend some time in there because I'm always struck by people who have done what you've done, like take a thing that you know a lot about and are passionate about, and then move it from passion project to, you know, something that sustains a family. That's a significant difference. But before we get into that, man, would love to dig into your own origin story. And, you know, if you wouldn't mind, tell me about your father. How would you characterize that relationship?
Yeah, well, my awareness or my understanding of him kind of starts around when I was about 13 years old, because him and my mom got divorced, I think, when I was younger than a year old. They were both around like 18, 19 years old when I was born, and then they divorced. Both in Pennsylvania. He lived in Western Pennsylvania. She lived in Eastern Pennsylvania. She moved back home with family. I used to go visit that side of the family every year, a couple of weeks a year, 2 to 4 weeks, and stay with my grandmother, who's still sort of like a seminal voice and presence in my life. She passed on right around the time I was 13. It was about that time that I didn't know if I was going to keep going out there to see family anymore, because grandma passed and she was sort of the organizing principle for the whole family and for my connection to it, which included 11 aunts and uncles. It was a big family, and then tons of cousins. And like her house was just sort of Grand Central all summer, which I loved being there for that. That's how I developed relationships with that side of the family. And my dad, I don't really know the details of his story up until that point, but he struggled with alcohol and smoking too much weed and struggling to keep employed and that sort of thing for a long, long time. And so he wasn't really a part of my life during almost that entire process of coming to that age. And it wasn't until maybe the year before she passed, when I was around 13, that he stopped in and basically like tried to make a deal, you know, tried to like be a part of my life again and say, here's who I am. And that sort of thing. And he wanted me to come stay with him the next time I came out that summer. And he had started a new family. he was very clear to me when I met him that he was somehow like worse off than my uncles, who I knew pretty well from going out there those summers. Like they always seemed like smart, gainfully employed, healthy kind of individuals, you know, and he seemed kind of sad and weak and scared and a little shook, you know, like he wasn't really confident in the way he was talking. And even at 13, I just remember this sort of general perception. And I kind of felt like I was weird. Like this emotion I'm about to describe is maybe something that I still carry with me in lots of parts of my life. But I felt obliged to sort of give him that, you know, like, I think I could be this for you, which is a weird thing to feel as a 13-year-old.
Right. Like you feel sorry for him or
let me
do you this solid.
Yeah. Like I definitely felt parental, you know? And so I spent a couple summers with him and like it mostly went okay. You know, it was sort of like a weird getting to know your dad time. It felt very like after school special in a lot of ways. And there were all these sort of like small moments that meant a lot that I look back on now and sort of chuckle about for better and worse. And he would hook me up with all his like lawn mowing jobs because he was sort of just like a handyman. That's how he was employed. And he made a decent amount of money just mowing lawns and stuff. And for the summer, he'd like let me take over like a portion of his lawns and I would get to mow them. And that was kind of cool. And he gave me a ton of independence. Like he let me refinish the attic in his house where he already had two kids that were much younger than me with this new family. And he gave me the attic and like let me hang out up there and like have this like what felt like a palace at the time. The big screen TV and video games and a big bed and all that. He was definitely trying to like win me over. He seemed to feel like he had to do that. He wasn't totally wrong. I definitely was looking to feel wanted, you know. And then and things didn't go so well with his family after that. You know, I think he had some job troubles and was maybe into drugs and alcohol again too much. And that kind of fell apart. And there were some moments where I think he may have been, you know, a little abusive and things like that. I don't really have the details for that. But grandma died. Things went bad for him. And I just quit going. Like that was like the end of my summers in Warren, Pennsylvania, which were a big deal to me. And I didn't really have much contact with him after that. I don't think I saw him for about 15 years. He came to my second wedding with my wife, Hillary, that I'm married to now and have two kids. That was maybe the first time I'd seen him in 15 years. I never imagined he would come, but he did. And that was weird. It was very weird. He ended up getting way too drunk and pulling a knife on somebody around the fire because they wouldn't give him a cigarette. That's how I remember that ending.
Yeah, I was there.
You were there.
Man.
You were there.
I don't remember anything about the campfire issue. I DJ'd your wedding.
That's
and
right.
I remember there being like kind of a little like buzz, like, oh, you know, Kaiser's dad showed up. Oh, Kaiser's dad's here. And and that was kind of it. Like, I don't think I ever talked to him or really interacted with him, but I knew that his presence there was kind of like odd.
Yeah.
It brought a layer of, you know, maybe tension to things.
Yeah, for sure.
And I was glad, like, I mean, I didn't know about this night, thing, but I felt like, okay, cool. Like he came and things went fine and like, good thing he didn't blow up the wedding, you know? And
yeah. I mean, it sounds like it's a crazy story to hear and then say like, but things kind of went fine, but they kind of went fine. Like the guy who told me that, you know, my dad pulled the knife on him mostly told it as sort of like a jokey survival story, you know, like, oh, that was crazy, dad. I was like, oh, Lord. But what's crazy is my uncle Alan was there as well, who is sort of like the guy that I've replaced my dad with mentally and emotionally. And to this day, like, he's the first person I think of when I think about that whole side of the family. He was there and nobody thought that was odd, you know, like he just like slipped right in. The group of people that he was surrounded by, like all these young hip kids from the city of Chicago. And he spends most of his time at his hunting cabin up in the Allegheny National Forest these days, you know, so he was definitely a fish out of water, but he didn't care, you know, like he wasn't disjointed in the situation. He just fit in as himself, as this like generous, caring, thoughtful person that was like excited to be there for all the right reasons. Yeah, I don't know. I learn a lot and I still think a lot about the contrast between those two individuals and like how that plays out for me.
Did he take that role on for you early on or kind of later in your teen years?
Early. Like, and I don't think he knows it. It wasn't until, I don't know, maybe 6 or 8 months ago, I had a chance to like sit around the fire at his cabin in Pennsylvania and like tell him that.
How did he receive it?
Jesus. I think he was a little shook because he was trying to describe to me what it meant to his life to lose his mother, my grandmother. And I think that was the only time, or maybe the first time at least, that he and I bonded as adults. That was, Jesus.
It's all right.
That was definitely the first time that he and I ever shared an experience or spoke about something in a way that wasn't like uncle and nephew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, two men profoundly impacted by the same event, but probably in different and similar ways.
Yeah, that was, Jesus, this whole episode is going to make me cry.
Oh, man, it's had that effect on a couple people, man. You're not alone in that. We don't give each other enough space to talk about things unless it's like in a closed room with a therapist or something. And
yeah, well, there was a moment where I could hear the pain in his voice still hanging around, and there was something about the way he said it. I don't remember what he said. I just remember how it felt when he described like how much he lost by losing her. It was I could tell that he had said that to other people, but they didn't feel it themselves. That for a lot of other folks, maybe it was different or less profound, or it hurt them a little bit less than it did him. Mm-hmm. When I told him what it meant to me, I could tell he was shocked to find another person who felt that way. So yeah, I think he felt seen in that moment. I think it was a little shocking for him. And when I saw, I guess when I saw how alone and vulnerable he felt by that, it felt really important for me to explicitly articulate to him the role he played for me growing up. It was clear to me that he didn't feel all that valued on this planet for a while. You know, he's had struggled with his own kids and his brothers and sisters and everybody, you know, without that organizing principle of my grandmother still around, the family's been pretty disparate, it feels like. Not as much connection, and I could tell he really senses the loss of that. And I really wanted him to hear me in no uncertain terms, like how important he was to me when I would come out there in the summers and he would spend time, and he doesn't remember any of it because it didn't mean that to him. He was just being himself, but... I remember specifically he brought a jar of money to me that had like coins and bills from all around the world in it. And I thought that was like the craziest thing I'd ever seen. And to this day, I thought he had traveled the world, you know, as like a young guy with, you know, without anything tying him down, he must have just like traveled the world and collected these things and brought them home. And I find out now, you know, within the last year, he's like, oh, I haven't been anywhere, man. I don't even know how I got that shit. It's probably just something he found at like a garage sale and was like, oh, Michael Paul will like this. And who knows? Those things take on such a crazy importance.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. So that was a big deal to tell him what he meant to me in that role, and the time that he took and how gentle he was about it all. Yeah, there wasn't a lot of gentleness in life back then. And that was a big deal for me.
Yeah. Considering what your dad did for a living or the different jobs and things that he had, I'm curious where you found inspiration for this entrepreneurial path. We often model ourselves after the things we see as possible growing up. And so I'm curious if it wasn't him, things you might have seen from other father figures, other men in your life that impacted you in your own creative pursuits.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely always thought it was fascinating that Alan had like his own carpentry business. Like I don't think he ever worked a job that I was aware of. He always like had his own business. And that was a small influence for sure. I always thought he just seemed more capable because of that. He just seemed to know so much more about the world from having done that. But mostly through the rest of my life, not having that central father figure. My mother remarried and I had a stepfather for a while that was sort of his own tragic figure in a way. He lost his job. He did something stupid and then he got depressed and couldn't go out and find work again. He just became this like very tragic figure that was sort of sad and weak, very similar to what my father had represented to me. So that was like scary stuff for me. Mm-hmm. And in the lack of that, I basically just became like obsessed with finding other people who could teach me something about what it's going to be like to be an adult man in this world. So a lot of my friends at school who had, you know, some of them had fathers that were really interesting or, you know, particularly generous or kind with their time, or they were just interesting to pay attention to and understand more about what they did in the world. I would pay so much attention to them. Every word they would say would, you know, just felt like it was going into this lexicon for me. Or preachers in the church that I grew up with who were fascinating sort of parental figures. There were baseball coaches. Jesus, my baseball coach till today, Mr. Hendershot and Mr. Esposito, those two fucking guys. it feels like they are like always like in the back of my head somewhere with some line I heard them say that all of a sudden seems relevant today, you know, for the first time ever. Yeah, all that stuff, it just gets in there and takes up space and starts to shape how you see the world. And I think I was maybe hungrier for that than most kids are who have, you know, who have that dominant example in their own house.
Yeah.
That stuff has shaped me. So, and that carries through to, you know, your peers when you're in your 30s and you're surrounded by smart, creative people, some of which are starting their families or, you know, they're on a career path. You know, people like you, Creighton Berman, other people I've worked with. I don't know. I've always felt like I was the 16-year-old around people like you guys. And so we all get stunted somewhere, right? And that's who we think we are in the world. And so it's very hard for me to not feel like I'm still that kid soaking that up and watching what other people do and then figuring out, like, how do I do that part of it well? And, you know, or if I ever get a chance, like, that's how I'm going to do it. And like, you just keep benchmarking these things just over and over and over again. I don't know. Somebody told me once that like the person who has deconstructed and rebuilt something will be better at it than the person who just figured it out the first time.
Oh yeah.
Man, I was in that deconstruction phase until I was 35. And I guess I'm still there, but like that was where it all kind of added up to me to make the jump. There was enough of it at that point that I could make the move.
I tell my students something similar all the time. And, you know, this idea of being perfect or right or like nailing something on the first try, like that is not interesting. Like, there's nothing fun about like lucking out and solving it on the first go. Like that's usually your worst idea is for your first sure. idea.
I mean, if there's one thing that starting this business taught me was that I was inherently limited based on my prior experiences when it comes to running a business, because I was a specialist. Even in the generalist role I had at this agency that we worked at, in the world of life and running a business, I was still a specialist. I knew the world of design within business. And I had a real hard first 3 years of running this, getting to the point where I had to tell myself, you need to learn these things that you're not good at and that you don't like. You need to get just as good at them as you do all these other things that you love and enjoy and come easily to you. And those are realizations that come like just after you're starting to have a full-on breakdown, when you're like, I can't do this. The help that I need is not available or doesn't exist, or I don't even know how to articulate the ask. Sometimes it's simple shit. Like you're going to sit down today, watch every YouTube video you need to know how QuickBooks works. You, you child, like figure it out.
Yeah. yeah, man.
And then there's bigger things like, you know, learning how to talk to a lawyer and an accountant, or how to talk to an employee who's going through a patch where it's not working out so well for them and you're not getting, you know, you're not getting what you both need to be doing. Those are big things you got to learn how to do well. And that never stops. Like that became this like internal mantra for myself of recognizing when I was having like static thinking, which is thinking like, I can't do this, I don't know how to do this, or I'm not good at this, or this is just who I am, I have to accept the limitations. Like all of that kind of negative self-talk is really about comforting you from the unknown and trying to help you like rationalize your fears, versus this like elastic thinking of, if this is important enough and my business needs it, I'm going to figure it out one way or another, because everybody who started a business before me did it, I have to be able to do it. It is something you can figure out. I had to start admitting that to myself, because when I would articulate that and I would say, you can figure this out if you wanted to, I immediately feel enough shame to go do it, which is how this whole thing started for me. Like I watched numerous people who I felt I had the similar level of skills or drive or creativity or whatever. I had enough of those things that it became embarrassing for me that I hadn't gone and done the thing I should do on my own yet. And I was still just like hovering in fear at this day job. For me, getting to that level of embarrassment or shame that I haven't done the thing is basically the last ditch motivation for me to go finally fucking do it.
Yeah.
I've tried to get ahead of that now so that I don't have to experience so much of that by creating these like internal monologue kind of tools for myself, which have been a big deal. But sometimes it still comes down to just feeling shamed.
That's a powerful motivator. And I guess when used the way you do it, that's the catapult out of the perceived comfort of you know, consulting life into a new thing or the unknown or something you're going to have to do, you know, really 100% on your own. Like,
right.
You know, you didn't have any wealthy patrons who were like, that's a great concept. I'm going to fund that. And then all you need to do is just like make it real. You had to do 100% of it.
Yeah, no, you know? This thing had to make money from day one. There was no other option.
Yeah, I want to get into that moment and sort of where it fits in. At that point, you were married.
Yeah, married. I can't remember for how long, but it was when she got pregnant that I felt the window of opportunity closing. But I felt it in a way that I think is maybe counterintuitive to a way a lot of people would have assessed that rationally. Most people would have said like, you know, oh, we're about to have a baby. Like, I need to lock down my day job, make sure this is cool, and like get ready for life to change. When I found out we were going to have a baby, I was basically like looking at my watch being like, I've got 8.5 months to make this thing profitable and have a business and a business that I could take a little time off from in order to transition to that new life of having a baby. I've got 8 months to make this thing happen. And so I lined up two clients that I didn't know how long I was going to have them or how big they were going to get. And I had 6 months salary in the bank, which seems like a lot, but it goes fast, and jumped. That's when I hung the shingle and started doing. So it started out as basically consulting in the beer industry, which I had a good bit of experience doing from high to low. So my, you know, my first two clients, one was a tiny little startup that didn't even have a name yet. And the other one was AB InBev, their high-end portfolio. That was a relationship that was born out of a couple of things that I was working on the side when I started writing about beer. So that gave me the confidence that there were people like out there that saw my perspective as valuable enough that they would pay for it. Some of which, you know, they were willing to pay well. Other people were willing to scrape together the pennies they had to make it happen. And I decided that that was enough for me to go on. You know, I always told, I had to keep telling myself, worst case scenario, you come do this job again. Either here or somewhere else. I had to keep telling myself, like, you're not going to end up homeless on the street starving. To this day, I don't believe myself when I say that, but I can tell myself that loud enough that it usually gets me over the hump.
Yeah.
Growing up as a real poor kid in central Pennsylvania, I don't think you ever really believe that there's much between you and the street. And that definitely motivates me sometimes, you know, sometimes for worse. That is a motivator for me big time. And so leaving with 6 months salary felt like just enough for me to be like, you're crazy for not trying.
Yeah. To be clear, for people that aren't familiar with Good Beer Hunting, it started as a blog and you writing about beer.
Yeah, it started as a Tumblr.
Yeah. You'd been doing that for some time before you kind of made a name for yourself and were able to earn these two clients' business.
Yeah. Without that blog, there was no reason for anybody to know that I existed or take my perspective seriously at all. I'd basically written myself into the center of the industry where they, you know, people were asking big strategic questions, and I was writing about those things. Basically started, you know, we were working on beer projects as an agency, at both agencies I was at. One worked with Miller, the other one worked with AB InBev. That got me paying attention and interested in the beer industry just from like a factors and strategic perspective. For people who don't know, beer is a gnarly, gnarly industry in terms of regulation. Distribution laws are different state to state. You know, what you're allowed to put on a package is different and complicated. And so most people would be turned off by that. I was drawn to it because anytime there's something complicated, I feel like there's opportunity there and I want to know more about it. But I started noticing all these tiny little sort of cottage industry types opening up all around the country. When I would travel for work, I would always end up finding a little brewery that somebody was trying to launch basically as like a hobby business. At the time, most of them weren't really taking it all that seriously, even though they were putting everything on the line. So I just started writing about what they were doing and how that factored into the larger beer business and, you know, what was going to be disruptive and how and why and when. I don't know if you remember when medium.com launched. I saw that and I was like, oh, this looks like a cool blogging tool. Like maybe this would be better than the shitty Tumblr I have. And I wrote down, I sat down at lunch at Gravity Tank and I just like pecked out this like perspective I'd been noodling on called Meet Your Makers, which was basically an argument that the larger brewing corporations of the world, AB InBev and Miller Coors and all them, were they were going to inevitably make the beers that craft brewers today are making. That's not their biggest challenge. It's just that's an engineering and technical problem for them to solve. What will be the hardest problem for them to solve will be whether or not they can make anybody care that they're the ones making it. Popped that up on the Medium, walked away, went back to my desk. A couple days later, we got a phone call from the guy running the high-end portfolio at Anheuser-Busch down in St. Louis. And he wanted to talk. He wanted help figuring out exactly how to solve that problem because that was the problem that he was being tasked with. And that was a shock to me. It was a complete shock that that had ended up on his desk basically as a white paper. He didn't know anything about me, didn't understand what Good Beer Hunting was, probably wouldn't have found it had it not been on Medium. I don't think he was scraping beer blogs or Insight at the time. So I ended up going down there, and this was a great moment for me, actually. I went down there with Scott Turnovitz, one of the founding partners of Gravity Tank. And he came along on it basically because they called my day job to ask for me. They didn't call me personally. And so I was in this awkward position of like, the business development unit being like, so they want to talk to you. So Scott came down there with me because he was eager to get to know the folks down in St. Louis. We'd mostly been working with the folks out of New York on the InBev side up until then. We went through the pitch, told them about Gravity Tank, and they showed, you know, they talked about their problem, what they were trying to solve. And at the end of it, we walked out of there and Scott said, he was like, so I think it's clear that they're not trying to hire our agency. They're trying to hire you. I was like, okay, because I was still in like, make sure you pitch the agency mode because it was a kind of a weird scenario. He's like, you have my permission to moonlight on this for a couple of months and see what you can get out of it. He's like, if we end up with a client out of it, great. If not, you're starting your own business. And that was, and I don't know if that's exactly how he said it, but that's sort of like the legend in my own mind of how that went down. And yeah. I remember just feeling really grateful that he saw that as an opportunity for me, not as a loss of an opportunity for him.
Right.
Because he didn't have to do that. Like he gained nothing by...
he could have made it hella awkward to the point that you would have just been like, yeah, you know what? I'm not going to do this because it's making everything really weird.
100%. But yeah, and I mean, I had just been promoted to to the strategy group in the business at the time, which was a big deal for me. And so he was potentially, inviting one of his lead strategists to go run their own business in beer. But I don't think if he hadn't said that to me so clearly and generously, but so clearly, I don't think I would have felt as compelled. I would have been stuck in the mode of trying to figure out how to make it a side hustle instead of my main thing.
Right. I mean, as an entrepreneur, he probably saw that clearer than you did and knew the right thing to do as a friend and mentor and not like a, your employer,
right.
Which is pretty... pretty big. So,
I bet he didn't even think it through that far. I bet he just has the confidence in himself and his own business that he didn't even consider the cost to him. I think he was just like, well, this is clearly the thing you should go do. I think he just did it objectively and like with excitement for what he saw, because he's just that kind of guy. He's just like excited about what makes sense and like opportunities that way. And he just kind of said like, yeah, man, go for it. That's what you're doing. That was a life-changing moment for sure.
This show is sits at this intersection of creativity and fatherhood, and I use creativity really broadly, and I've had authors and filmmakers and DJs and all kinds on the show. And your degree is in poetry, and when I met you, I knew that you were a great writer. I think that's how somebody had first described you. And you've worked in interaction design and then later in the strategy group within Gravity Tank, and so you could point to that and say, oh, he's done a lot of different things, and all of that probably has a role in the work that you do. But what do you consider yourself now, if not designer? Like when you describe yourself, or like what do your kids think that you are? Do they understand the business?
Oh man, definitely not. Although they know, they're happy to point out whenever I'm drinking coffee or beer. Like, Daddy, that's your beer. Daddy, that's your coffee. That's as far as they know. Yeah, what is my role now? I'm kind of caught between two different roles that I'm struggling to hold both ends of at the moment. One is, I started the company, but I'm basically the product manager and creative director. Like I oversee the creation of both the editorial side of the business, which is massive. There's like 40 people on that side. We have an editorial director, but like I'm still in charge of the end product in a way. We have an editor, we have designers, we have writers, we have a content person who like populates everything. And like, but I'm sort of the only one that sees it all in one view, and that's a problem. And I've been trying to help people kind of step up high enough in this thing to like be able to see it all from the same point of view that I have, so that I can not be the only one doing that anymore. That's a huge, huge job, and it's only a small percentage of what I get to do. And the other side is running the studio team. So as creative director, we've got three designers that we work with here on the daily, and then there's other illustrators and designers we bring in for specialty projects and clients that we execute on. And so I run that, and that's where I spend probably the majority of my time, running the small studio here in Chicago. And that's a big job for anybody to do. I think I'm uniquely suited to be the creative director in a small studio like that because I have been a writer. I've worked on design teams. I've managed teams of interdisciplinary folks, places like Gravity Tank. I know what product innovation looks like. I know when process helps and when it hurts. I'm pretty good at taking an emotional read of the people around me and understanding when they're in pain and when they need to be freed up, what's motivating them. Like all of those things are things that I think I'm uncommonly good at from the experiences I've been lucky enough to have on the way to this role. But that's also a role that I can't singularly occupy anymore because now I'm spending more and more of my time working on the business itself, trying to figure out what phase two and phase three looks like in terms of growth and revenue streams. And what kinds of revenue we're looking for. Like, are we looking for higher margin hours? Are we looking for partnerships with long-term upside? Am I looking for someone who can help me get a product to market? And then we develop, you know, passive income from a product that we created ourselves. Like, all of those are new problems I'm trying to work on now. But it's hard to balance that when you're still creative director and product manager of two other things. So I'm going through a lot of pain right now trying to enable the people around me who I think would do a great job at those things, who just need to move at a different pace than the business would like them to move into those roles right now. Like they need time to like cure and like get in there and like make some mistakes and not have everything on the line and like learn from them and develop. And but I can see the opportunity for the business in the next 18 months to be in a totally different place. And I'm very eager to get there because like that's my new job and I want to go be really effective at that. But you know, I have to move at a pace that supports the people who are moving into those roles behind me really well. It's really difficult to be patient when you see opportunities like that. And you just want to go do it. You know, as a business owner, the people around you, you sometimes get a little like impatient and frustrated. And then other times you appreciate that they kind of had a governor on you a little bit and didn't let you move as quickly as your instincts allowed because sometimes those instincts are off. But you don't really know which ones are which when you're in the mix. So I've really been trying hard to like just develop a better sense of discernment for those moments right now.
I can't tell if you're talking about running a company or being a dad.
Dude, running a company feels so fucking parental sometimes. Like you think you're responsible for like health insurance and like salaries, but we live in this world where we put so much expectation on the people who are mentoring us in a professional sense to be sort of caretakers of us as people and emotional beings as well. Man, sometimes that sounds beautiful and other times that sounds like, dude, I'm not your fucking dad, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, man.
I really struggle with that intersection sometimes.
The thing I'm still struck by is your choice in those early days when you described exactly what I would have done. If I was kind of toying with the idea and kind of kicking it around of starting my own thing and found out that Maris was pregnant, I'd be like, oh, yep, nope, that's not happening. And I'm going to put this over here and lock it away for a while. And I'm just going to double down on full-time work and commit to this thing. And instead you're like, okay, so I got eight months to get this thing off the ground. And not a lot of people do that. Like that's the sort of risk-taking entrepreneurial spirit that I long for in myself, and you saw it several years ahead. And so you make this move, and you guys are pregnant. And so you've got all of this new stuff that's about to occur, becoming a dad. It's a countdown to that, and it's also a countdown to the birth of a business. Tell me about kind of the emotions and conversations that you're having with Hillary, and like think back to that moment you find out you're having a kid. Tell me about it.
Yeah, I mean, even to this day, I feel like that decision was more wrong than right, and I've just made the most of it. Because something that happens when you start a small business that I didn't anticipate, I knew it was going to be hard and scary and all those like personal things. I didn't know that it was going to be trauma. And I didn't know that it was going to be trauma at the level that it would obscure the trauma that my wife was about to go through in becoming a mother. There was a time, and I can see it now, and I saw a little bit of it then, but didn't see it clearly enough, that she felt invisibly pregnant for a long time because I was so in the weeds trying to get the business built that it felt like I'll take care of this and then we'll have a baby. But having a baby is a much longer timeline than when you're having the baby. And so that was a real struggle. It was a struggle for me to realize. It was a struggle for her to articulate. In both scenarios, I don't think either of us felt entitled to ask the other one for anything of much. Like, she was doing something like profound and sacred and hard and earthly and going through all of this. And that's, I'm talking about someone who loves being pregnant. Like, she loved being pregnant. Physically, it was a great experience for her. I can only imagine how much worse it would be for someone who hates being pregnant, which is a lot of people. So I'm saying all this one in the context of somebody who loved it. And it was still this like sad experience to a degree of feeling like she's about to do the most important, biggest thing that she's ever done in her life and in our family's life. And it doesn't feel priority enough because I'm trying to build a business for the first time and it's totally stowing me over. And the moments that I get where I come up for air and like feel okay for a minute are mostly about me feeling okay for a minute, not checking in on her. So that was a really difficult time. But I think it got even worse when we had our second child, Ellsworth, 2 years later. And not a lot had changed in that scenario. And part of that for us, I think, was that she had never really felt recognized for her experience of that first go around. How she kind of felt a little let down by that, even though that was, she liked being pregnant. She felt a little let down, I think, on our marriage dynamic, as our relationship dynamic in that context. And I had felt similarly let down and abandoned for what I was going through. Like, I was coming home to a person who all I wanted to do was tell them how painful life was and talk about how much help I needed and how scared I was. And her justifiable reaction of like, that is like, that's adorable. I'm having a child. And, you know, I mean, but I also don't want to diminish how comparable those things kind of are for the toll that they take on you. Like, I don't feel shy about saying, I think the trauma is at least relatively speaking comparable. It was the scariest, hardest, most doubtful, physical and emotionally damaging thing I think I had ever taken on in my life. And for her, relatively speaking, that was what she was going through as well. Although, all things aside, hers is creating a human being and profoundly more important in the end result. But I think the relative experience of that pain is very, very similar. And so we ended up on the other side of that, feeling like we'd each gone through it entirely alone. And I think that took a real toll on us for a long time. And I think it's taken us, they're now 5 and 3. And I feel like only in the last year have we come out of the sort of fog of that all happening at once. Two kids and a company. That happened over the last 5 to 6 years. And I think a big part of that was that we kind of had to let go some of that disappointment and focus on what we wanted out of our life now.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that the business is easy. It's not. It's just as hard today as it was 5 years ago. And having those kids is not easy. It's not every single day. There's some new scary thing that we've got to confront, especially with our oldest, you know, having Down syndrome. That's something that we confront pretty profoundly every day in some regard. And so none of this has gotten easier and none of it's gotten sorted out, but we've been able to look at it standing on the same side for the first time. And that took 5 or 6 years to get to the other side of that.
Yeah. Can you pin that pivot or that transition or the sort of the taking of each other's perspectives to end up on the same side? Can you pin that to anything in particular, or is that
No, I can't. For me, it felt slow and gradual and progressive. For her, it felt like a switch just flipped at some point. And it felt like she had a perspective that was just very different than what the perspective she had the day before. I've actually been asking her about it a lot lately because it's been so tangibly different for me. And I feel like I'm talking to a person with like a totally new capacity for something. And I think for her, it just happened so gradually that she doesn't see the night and day. And so I think it's hard for her to articulate unless she's keeping it a secret from me. It's been the thing that I think I and we, her and I, have been longing for so long as a couple going through all of this together. It's easy for people to see that when you're having a kid with somebody that you are, you know, to some degree, you're in that shit together and you have to sort it out together. And whatever is traumatic for one person affects the other. We don't talk about starting a small business, especially one like mine, which is bootstrapped and cash flow sensitive, and it's in the services industry, basically. We don't talk about that with the same kind of effect it's going to have on a family. We tend to talk about entrepreneurialism in this zeitgeisty tech startup, like you're going to make it someday kind of like bullshit language. And we don't talk about the toll it takes on you physically and psychologically and emotionally through all of that. You know, people who don't do this are right not to do this. Like, there's no wrong answer here of do it or don't. And like, what it gets, there's a cost. There's a real cost to doing it. And I don't think you know that until you go through it in a way that I think I could similarly describe becoming a parent. You don't realize the cost, the toll that it takes on you until you do it. Nobody can really adequately prepare you for that. And I don't mean to sound like doom and gloom. Like, people told me having a kid was terrible and I believed them. And I think they're speaking in hyperbole when it comes to having one kid. Like, I found that to be fairly simple. You know, I don't want to say easy because it's hard, but it's simple. Having two is, you know, that's another level. I think they undersold me on that.
I love when I talk to people who have like just one more than whatever I think is the max, you know? So like, I thought similarly, well, I want to get into this too, but like, you and I have talked, like I never really wanted children. I never saw myself as being a dad. I saw myself as being like a cool uncle to other people's.
Oh, I did not know that about you. That is not how I would see you at all. That's crazy that you thought that about yourself.
Yeah, man. I thought
You were like dadcore before dadcore was a thing.
I think I just saw them as diametrically opposed. Like, committing fully to fatherhood and being a good dad stood in the way of like this enormous bucket list of creative things I wanted to get done. And I saw myself putting all of those on pause to be the best dad possible. And I didn't understand how people could strike a balance, and I fell victim to the narrative of the same bullshit that every, you know, so many dudes say when you're like, oh yeah, me and Hillary are pregnant, and they, you know, all the ribbing, all the like, oh, you can put your gym membership aside, or, you know, like, I'll see you in 18 years, ha ha ha, you know, like that shit. And I believed it to be true even before we were pregnant. And so for me, you know, one was a lot, and then I have two, which seemed insane. But now I talk to people with three and I'm like, oh no, three, that's crazy. And then those people are like, oh man, my brother's got four. That's crazy. And then, you know, you talk to this guy and he's like, no, five is nuts. I'm like, you guys are all fucking crazy. All babies, all of them are hard. I don't care how many you have. You're all lying.
I think once you hit three, you can have 12 and you won't feel the difference. Like, at that point, just like toss another one on the pile of life. Like, it's fine.
Well, if
fine.
You spread them out like, enough, you know, they start to kind of take care of
themselves.
It's
not even that. You could have all 12 right now. They could all be 5 years old and feel exactly the same as having 3 5-year-olds.
12 tuplets. Let's do it.
Because like, you've only got, there's only so much you can do and only so much you can care about. And at some point, you know, like, there might as well be 12.
Yeah.
Like, I've got nothing left to give.
Yeah.
You'll do just fine dicing this up between you all. It's like a ration.
So did you always want children? Did you and Hillary come to that idea together? Or?
Yeah. I definitely always imagined myself as a father. It was basically like a thing I mentally prototyped the way that, you know, we joke about some women like fantasizing about their wedding. Like, I fantasized about being a dad all the fucking time.
Wow.
And it was, you know, I think a lot of it was for me was like rooted in this like, the sort of drama of, you know, in my own head of like growing up without a dad and like wanting to fix that. And like, I'm going to be really fucking good at that. And everything I'm learning is going to be a part of that. These are all pieces to that puzzle of me being a great dad. And just knowing that, like, I wanted to do it well. I think a big part of that was, like, you know, wanting to make up for what I had missed and feeling like I owed that to somebody. Mm. I realize now I was probably thinking of myself as my own child and wanting to, like, heal myself in a way. I always felt weak or like I was missing something. I always felt like there was secret knowledge in the world, or like my friends who had good families and especially good dads, like I always felt like they had this, like, almost like a talisman that I didn't have access to growing up. And I just felt like I was obligated to create that and pass that along. I don't know. Sometimes when I think about it in churchy terms, you know, like growing up as a Pentecostal Christian, like I did, which was its own sort of drama, I sort of saw it as like breaking a bad lineage, you know, like I'm going to be the guy that hits the reset button on this like terrible narrative. And if I do nothing else in my life, I wanted to accomplish that. That's gotten more complicated for me over the years, but that's still sort of a driving factor, especially when I feel like I'm failing, when I feel like I'm not doing well. I didn't know this until now, but I picture myself in the bedroom I grew up in thinking those thoughts.
Whew. Yeah. I don't assume you remember this, but I remember where I was when you told me that Leo had Downs. Mm. That moment of learning that news sits in my mind alongside a lot of other moments of like, oh, I can pinpoint exactly where I was at the time I was actually getting off the Brown Line and walking to work. And I remember you telling me so... It wasn't nonchalant at all, but it was also like really confident. It was like, this is a thing, alongside any other sort of update a dad would give a colleague about his kid. And I remember that moment because I thought to myself, there's no fucking way I could have just said that the way he did. And I also felt really ill-equipped, like, you know, like, what do you say? Or how do you acknowledge that in a way that is most appropriate, which is... That's interesting. That's scary. That's just one more awesome feature of this kid. Like, how do you? And so I don't even remember what I said, but I remember like hanging up with you feeling like, well, I didn't handle that very well. And, and just thinking like, man, later on, I need to ask Michael, like, what's the best way to receive information like that? And he'll know. He'll know later what that would have been. And so I guess I'm kind of asking now, like, you know, when talking about friends whose children have Downs, for anybody listening, like how do you respond? What's the best way to be?
Man, I mean, you know, the tell me more thing is probably pretty useful there. Mm. But I have to admit, like when I said that to you, I was going through a phase of trying to prototype, how do you fucking tell somebody this? Mm. It was painfully obvious to me that when you tell somebody that your kid has Downs, they are immediately in a position of not knowing what the fuck to say back. Because I'd already experienced it probably 100 times by the time I told you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I pay attention to the way that people talk and the words they choose. And, like, that's sort of a thing. And I learned really quickly that, like, oh, everybody's either going to tell you, like, oh, God specials angels, which just makes me want to fucking punch them in the throat. Or they act super confused and concerned and, like, they don't know what to say to you, which basically treats it as a traumatic thing that I just said to you. You know, so I was going through this phase of, like, I'm going to practice telling people this in different ways to figure out what the best way to tell them is. When I told you, I think I was pretty close to like feeling confident in it, where I was just like, I'm just going to tell them this, like the kid has brown hair, because that will send the best possible signal to them that I can, that this is okay with me.
Yeah.
Because when someone tells you that they're going to have a baby with Downs, most people assume that must be terrible for you. And they're not wrong. Like there's a lot of terrible feelings and thoughts that go along when you're trying to sort out how you're ultimately going to feel about that scenario. And so I felt like the most generous thing I could do and the most productive thing I could do was signal as strongly as I could that I'm okay with this. That I'm going to say it to you, not in a cold way, but in a very matter-of-fact way.
Yeah, that's how I took it.
Yeah, so that you knew that this was just a thing, not the thing, you know?
Right, right.
And that seemed to work fairly well in most cases. Like, people were like a little surprised by that because you don't hear that very often, but at least they were just surprised by that rather than concerned. And so that got us a little bit further down the line quicker, and I was able to talk about it a little bit more freely. yeah, that was a weird time of like trying to figure out how to make other people okay with this thing that I was experiencing.
Yeah, I know, like you need any more burden on that. Let me factor out the world into this.
I mean, it's not that dissimilar, honestly, to where we started talking about like being 13 and trying to make my dad okay with me being a kid that he's disappointed, you know, like you're two steps ahead in this like emotional chess game that everybody's playing, and you're just trying to make them feel okay enough that you can move forward now.
Yeah, keep playing.
Yeah.
I know that Hillary was and maybe still is quite the advocate on social media of the visibility, like let's make this a normal thing,
yeah,
of kids with Downs, and they should be just as featured in kind of social media and kids things and in all the spaces that, you know, people thrust their cute kids into that mix. Is like, yeah, this is a normal thing, and if anything, we have to like over index on it to make it normal.
Totally.
And tell me about,
she's all about it.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Well, to go back to the question you asked right before this of like, did you always want to have kids? She didn't. I always pictured myself having the kids that I have right now, basically, like 5 and 3 years old. It's kind of like, those are kids in my mind. So I'm living the fantasy right now. She always fantasized about being like 60 years old and having your adult children and their children around a dinner table. And like, that's what having kids meant to her.
She has a long way to go before she gets that side of the story.
Oh, so fucking long. But that also means that like what she's experiencing now as being a mom of like toddlers,
yeah,
is not what she pictured at all. It's not, this is a means to an end for her in a way, you know, or at least that's how she started out. I don't think that's where she's at now. I think she's sort of kind of newly embracing what it means to be a mother to two crazy boys that are this age. And so her and I just have very different perspectives on like what the fantasy part of having kids really is. And so we have very different approaches to how to embrace Leo having Down syndrome. For me, it's like, fuck you all. This is my kid. I've got a big chip on my shoulder. I don't want to hear, like I said before, like, I don't want to hear people telling me about how special he is. I don't want them telling me about how, you know, how brave of a fucking dad I am for having this kid. I don't want to hear any of this like extra layer of bullshit. This is my kid and I'm proud of it. And this is what I've got. And I'm going to take him all the way to the finish line in my mind. Like this is who I'm with. But for her, it was in some ways the loss of a fantasy that she had about what her life having kids might be. And I think it's important for people to realize that we all fantasize about, you know, if you're going to have a kid, and that's something you think about, like you're fantasizing about a particular kid in your mind, and you have a very strong relationship with that fantasy. Like if you've ever read a fiction book and you sort of think about those characters sometimes in ways that are more than them being a character in a book, like, you know, that you spent a long time reading these characters and you feel attached to them or you learn something from them, like that's the fantasy life, man. And it's powerful. And you can do that by imagining the kid that you want to have. And when you have a kid that is born in a typical way, it takes you a long time to realize that kid's not the kid you fantasized about. They develop interests that are not yours. They have a personality that's not yours. You know, it takes a while for those things to sort out. You get to have this like 10-year period of like letting go of this fantasy. When you have a kid that is born in a way that is blatantly, obviously not the fantasy you had in mind, the kid in your fantasy dies. And it feels real. And so it takes some people longer than others to embrace that transition, but it's a real one. And you have to let go of that in a big way. And so we were really lucky that we found out early on that Leo was going to have Downs, because we had 6 to 7 months of rewriting the fantasy. By the time he showed up, I was like, that's my guy. But I don't think she had completely imagined herself in that role as a parent yet, because that was never the role she imagined when she thought about kids anyway. So the advocate that she has become, I think for her, I think she is trying to do the good that some other people had done for us in helping us achieve that fantasy faster. I remember when we were going through the phase of trying to decide, do we carry out this pregnancy or not, which is a real shitty thing that somebody hands you as a decision you get to make. God, we found, you know, just started Googling Down syndrome, because like, where else do you start? And like, everything I saw was just like, that is not the life I want to have or thought I would have. It's not the fantasy. It's the direct opposite of that. Like, so many of the visuals and the things we read about and the examples that we're given around Down syndrome are statistically not representative. I'm going to try to say this in the fairest way possible. Most people who have kids with Downs never do genetic testing because it is not within their religious interest to do so. And those are also people who would never terminate for the same reasons. Our doctors told us that somewhere between 80 and 90% of the people who do the genetic testing as part of, you know, their medical routine, if they find out they have Downs, they terminate. 80 to 90%, which is like an impossible number to consider. So when you start to go look for what is life with a kid with Down syndrome look like, you're automatically over-indexing by an insane margin on a life that is more associated with fundamentalist Christians or people who are otherwise religiously not interested in doing genetic testing and other things like that. And so the lifestyle that is reflected back at you feels incredibly foreign if that is not your lifestyle.
Wow, I never would have thought through how that impacts things.
And those kids get treated, you know, I don't want to say any of this is wrong, but it's not what I think is right. But those kids are often treated as special, as God's little angels, put up on a pedestal while they're also sort of secluded from the rest of the world. They don't leave home much. They are not treated like how we treat other full people in our lives in a lot of scenarios. They're treated as exceptions, as special. And I think these people think that they're doing it to their benefit, but I don't see it that way. Then I was able to take a step back and be like, well, who is that 10% that are part of the sort of belief structure, or at least a little bit closer to my belief structure, that still said yes? I want to know what that was like. I want to know what those lives are like. And that is how we stumbled onto this woman who has a blog. And I just remember scrolling through and just feeling like a wash of relief, like flow over me, because that life felt familiar. The pictures I saw, she had a big family, like 4 or 5 kids, one of which has Downs. And like, it just started to look like the pictures I had in my mind of what it's like to be a parent and have a family. And I'll never forget, there was photos from this one camping trip that they went on, and the whole family was there, mom, dad, all the other kids. And I just remember looking at it, and every photo I found myself like looking like, where's that kid with Downs? Where is it? Where is it? And I felt like a Where's Waldo sort of scenario of like, I just need to confirm for myself that the pictures I'm looking at include this child that feels like it would otherwise be an exception to this photo. And at some point, I stopped looking for the kid that had Downs and just started being charmed and inspired by the family that I was seeing in a more general sense. And I remember turning to Hillary and saying, I closed the computer and I tossed it aside on the couch and I said, holy fuck. I was like, if you told me that this is the family that I could have, I'd pay you any dollar I could get my hands on to get it. I was like, I'm done with this decision. Like, there's no way I'm not doing this. But it took seeing that. It took realizing how exceptional we've made this thing in a negative way for me to realize how exceptional it could be in a positive way. From that moment on, for all intents and purposes, like, Leo does not have Down syndrome in my mind, or at least it's like the fifth or sixth thing I think about when I think about Leo. Like, that's just my kid, you know, and you're talking about my kid. And like, that's how I feel about it. Hillary, on the other hand, I think is really hungry to connect with people that are sharing a similar experience as her, people who, you know, have had to transition, I think, their fantasy into reality in a different way, in a different timeline, people who are literally living with the physical ramifications of giving birth to a child of that sort, that like, you live with it in a much different, very like earthly, like fearful way. Because, you know, there's complications with pregnancy that can arise. Leo had heart surgery at 6 months, open heart surgery. You know, for him, it's part of having Downs. It's a particular defect that's typical. So she lives with it in a very different way. And so I think she now feels compelled to go out there and be just as findable as that other woman was for us. She wants to be just as findable and effective for other people in that way. I like it when I get those moments to do that in a more like one-on-one way. Like, we've met some couples and we've shared our lives with them. As an example for what they might experience if they continue with their pregnancy with a kid with Downs. Like, I like the one-on-one thing, but I'm not interested personally in waving a banner, I guess, about it, because for me, that tells too big of a story for what this means for Leo. I think when Hillary does it, she's doing it in a way that she's telling a story about what it means for her as a mother. And I think it's incredibly powerful. As much as I don't want to do it, I love seeing her do it because I know what it means. Like, I now have a 3-year-old that's paying attention to everything, like everything. And I want to go as long as I can because I know I'm going to fail eventually, but I want to go as long as I can with him not realizing, or at least I don't want to be the reason he realizes that Leo is different. Because I think ultimately he's going to have to know because he has to be, like Ellsworth is, he is going to step into a role that is a burden in his adult life, taking care of this part of our family with us. The moment I see him recognize that his older brother is limited or is seen differently by the world, or whenever that moment is for him, I know it's going to break my heart. My hope is that when it happens, he's going to have years of reflection in his relationship with me and our interactions, that he's going to feel okay about that. He's going to be able to address it or internalize it as competently as he thinks that I have. So that's what it means when I matter-of-factly tell somebody, Leo, who happens to have Down syndrome, and then I start talking about other things, is trying to set the tone.
Yeah, you were successful in that for sure. And I think every interaction we have every so often, bumping into each other and reconnecting, that's always the mode in which you catch me up on both your kids equally. I never feel like I'm getting a special story for Leo that Ellsworth doesn't get, and that there's no time dwelling or wasted on anything other than the normal updates, you know, like how they're doing in school and what they're up to and how they interact with each other. And it's so regular when you talk about your kids. And it's funny that's something to remark about, you know, but I think considering the scenario, a regular update is just awesome. And, you know, I was reading this piece about how there's really no good way to describe children's resilience. And so the author had chosen the term anti-fragile, and that so many of the things that we think we just loused up as parents, like they're only painful to us because we're just big, fragile, dumb adults. And and like the kids are anti-fragile and like very elastic. And I'm always struck by things that I feel like I have to come to Javier and apologize for, like, you know, getting angry or raising my voice. I make a point that after I compose myself and get my shit together, I get down on his level physically and I look him in the eye and I always say, like, hey, sorry about that. I shouldn't have yelled about something so silly, and I'm working on that. Sometimes it was a big enough deal that, like, you know, we make eye contact and he says, you know, something more profound. But usually it's like, okay, you know, like, yeah. Is that making
usually
you feel better?
It's, usually for me,
that?
It's like, I want to watch Paw Patrol. It's like yeah. Great. I'm glad I invested all that into this moment.
But it's just like, I sort of don't get the fulfillment of that. Like, it's okay, Dad. We all make mistakes. But I also, come away feeling like he's fine. He would have let me know in that moment if I fucked up hard, and he didn't. Like, there's even moments where he looks at me and he's like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, oh, right. That wasn't a thing for you? Like, well, then never mind. I take it back.
Yeah, it goes both ways, man. There will be times when days later, like, yeah, Els will just be like, you hurt me. You know, I'm just like, when? Oh, yeah. What are you talking about? And he'll, like, act out a scene and I'll just be like, holy shit. I barely remember that happening.
Yeah.
What they decide to latch onto is not consistent with the things that we latch onto.
That's right. Maybe that's the better way to state that. I'm curious if you're, I mean, I know that you work in beer and craft beverage industry, and those are, you know, not for humans younger than 21 years old, but yeah. Do your children play a role in any of your creative endeavors? Do you have them around the studio? Do things that they do or say, like, influence your thinking or the business in any way?
Mm. Ellsworth, the youngest one, he's three. He's been to this studio once, but this is new for us. We just moved down here and it's been under construction for a while. So we haven't had any of that, but I've been kind of eager to make that happen because Leo goes to preschool for half the day and he's about to go to kindergarten in the fall for like full day. And that leaves kind of Ellsworth in like this floating space where we could sign him up for a bunch of classes or we could try and get him into a preschool, but it's not guaranteed. And so I've been thinking about having him here in the mornings, you know, for a few hours to give Hillary a break and get some alone time and like go do her own stuff. Cause she takes on, you know, she still does some design work on the side and has her own interests and she doesn't get a lot of time to really invest in any of that stuff. So we've been trying to figure out a way to like, how can I take some of that burden off? But also how can I get more of them in my life? It's a never ending sort of like lust for having them around. I'll never get enough of it, feels like. So we're trying to figure out a way for both of those things to happen. So having one of them here for part of a day, a few hours, seems newly achievable at the age that they're at. Before this, I think it would have been really hard. They would have wanted my attention the entire time, or they would have just gotten into stuff they can't get into and it would have been dangerous for them. You know, we're a design studio, so we've got like markers and scissors and X-Acto knives and shit like that everywhere. So they're at a new age where I think that's possible. And I'm kind of getting excited about the first time that happens. We decided to try that in the next week for at least one day to see how it goes. My hunch is it'll go really, really well for like 2 or 3 days. I'll get lulled into an expectation that that's always possible. And then I'll have a nightmare scenario. So I'm already trying to prepare myself for how it goes wrong and how I'm going to recover from that moment.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. They're still,
we'll see.
They're still young, but are you intentional about their creativity and opportunities to make in whatever shape that might look?
Yeah, with the chances that I get. I mean, Hillary has really been on top of a lot of that, but you know, trying to design their days basically and like make it exciting for them. And frankly, to make it exciting for her, because otherwise it can be kind of a drag, especially when they're so young that they don't really want to play with you a whole lot, you know, like you don't get that feedback of the interaction. That was kind of a hard slog for her. But now that they're a little older, I think that's a lot more fun for her. The things I would do to like try and make an impact in that way was, I remember we were at an antique shop and we found this huge drawing table, you know, like that tilts up, this old wooden and like iron kind of thing. And Hillary and I had been talking about, specifically Leo, because he was a little older, what can we do to find out what he's going to like a lot and then just encourage the shit out of that, you know, like give him something to dive deep into. Because he goes to school and he gets hit with a bunch of different things, but like he would come home and he would just like watch TV or like want to go outside and play, but he wouldn't really like get into anything. So I bought him this huge drawing board. I was like, let's just see what happens, you know? And so we set it in the corner and it's 3 times the size of him. We just put a big white sheet of paper on it and showed him, you know, like you can use the markers and the crayons. And he went to town on it. And I was initially just excited that he wanted to use it at all. But then he started doing something with it that was profound for me, where he didn't just like start drawing pictures. Like he would draw like a character, like a little circle. It looked like a balloon, like a head with a little tail on it. And for him, those were people, those were entities. He was like, this is you, and this is Uncle Pat, and this is Mom. And he would like draw them all. And then he would start acting out a story. And he would go, rawr! And I was like, what? He was like, monster! And I was like, oh! And then he would go draw the monster, like, near the people. And then he would come back and, like, act out another. And so he started doing this, like, live performance drawing thing. I was like, it was bizarre. But once I realized what he was doing, I was completely infatuated with it. Like, it felt like I was watching some sort of, like, esoteric creative thing on, like, a TED Talk or something.
Yeah.
Because he would demand your attention and then tell you what's happening next. And, like, and if you suggested something, he would get excited and then go draw that.
It's like a Pixar animation pitch.
Basically. You know, it felt a lot more like the work that we do.
Like, let me get into the character and kind of like, I mean, I've seen illustrators and animators with, you know, mirrors right at their desk so they could like, they could make a scowl or they can, you know, sort of get into the character and then quickly sketch that, you know, thing they just did physically. And I mean, he was doing that just naturally.
Big time, like with his whole body. It was amazing. Sometimes he'd like fall on the floor and act it out, and it was great. You know, so that was a real victory for me, and like being like, I could totally have an impact even in my limited amount of exposure to like giving him a platform to play on and like discover things. But I also found myself like writing off possibilities for him because he has Downs, which is something that I'm really vigilant about, but I still fall into sometimes. I remember hearing other dads like talking about their kids, like, oh, they're super into like Fortnite or Minecraft and like all these other like smart kid sounding things, and like me making the automatic assumption of like, oh, that's interesting, but like, nah, you know, like Leo's not going to get to that, not anytime soon. And one day I found myself thinking it like probably for the 100th time for some reason. And I was like, God, this thought pattern just sucks. I was like, I'm just going to download Fortnite and hand it to him and see what happens. Cause like, I don't know anything about Fortnite. Like it's a game I've never played before. It just sounds complex and, you know, something that smart kids do. And so I downloaded it on the PS4 and I showed him what I did with the controller. I was like, you can move these buttons and hit these buttons. And I just tried to like leave it pretty open for him. And he was intrigued. And he has the tiniest little hands. Kids with Downs tend to be on the smaller side. And so for a five-year-old, his hands are like, you know, they're smaller than my three-year-olds in some ways. But for him handling this like PS4 controller is ridiculous. It's like putting a kid in front of a starship. But he was like interested in it. Like something about the interaction like spoke to him. And he couldn't believe. I remember the moment when he looked up and he couldn't believe that he was controlling the thing that was on the TV. Like him trying to map that space in his mind. He was just like, what? I just got sucked into like the control of it. And, you know, he played and he got frustrated and he had no idea what to do. And I couldn't explain to him what to do because not only is it Fortnite, I didn't know how to play it, but trying to tell your five-year-old that you've never had a conversation with about using axes to break boulders. And like, how do I even find the vocabulary for this? And so, but he got it. And then he started playing around with it. He never lost interest. He was, you know, just frustrated, but still interested. I remember coming home after like 2 days of him doing it on his own while I was at work. And I saw him running around, like breaking down trees and rocks and building shit. And I was like, what in the world? And I was like, Hillary, what have you been showing him? And she's like, I haven't shown him anything. She's like, I don't know what any of those buttons do. I couldn't even get him to, I couldn't even figure out how to turn the system on. He had to show me. I was like, wait, what? So he'd wake up in the morning, go get the controller, turn the system on, navigate to the game that he wanted and just start playing.
Wow.
And it was so autonomous and so over the top for me. And so I was like, here I was, this like stupid dad telling himself like, oh, probably not for my kid. And this is something he's better at than anything he's ever tried.
Yeah.
So now every couple of weeks we get him a new game and he just barrels right through them and completes them. And there's, you know, kids come over for play dates that are a couple of years older than him. And like, he gets impatient with them because they suck at the game. And he's like yelling at them what to do. And like, I'm like, this is my kid. This is what I was like. And it was a profound lesson for me about like not deciding and not editing out for him like what he's up for, because he is crazy good at video games in a way that most kids are not, in a way that, you know, is better than I ever was at them, even though I really loved them. He just seems really good at it. He loves it. And now it's a thing where he's, you know, he comes in the morning, he's like, Daddy, two player. And like, he's like, come on. And he like drags me out there to like go play two player with him. And I can see him. It's funny. I see him sort of like parenting me through that moment because like he's concerned I don't know how to play. And like when we get something going and like, and he sees me figure it out, like he feels proud of himself for like having coached me through it.
Yeah.
And like, he's a big fucking person in that moment.
Yeah.
It's just all of Leo, all on, firing on all cylinders. And it's amazing to me. It just makes me smile every time I think about like how I didn't think he could handle it. I mean, this is a kid that he's in a mixed class in preschool, Chicago Public School. He's the only kid in there with Downs. Everybody else, you know, a third of them have some sort of delay, whether it's speech or behavioral or whatever. He's the only kid in there with something like Downs. The rest of them are all typical kids. And he's top of his fucking class.
That's awesome.
That's unbelievable to me.
Man, I think he's just going to have a lifetime of like proving you and everybody else wrong.
Yeah. Bring it on, man. I'm here for that. Yeah, I definitely now feel like I'm trying to keep up with where he's going, which is a good feeling.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I did my job of like getting him off the starting blocks in the best way I knew how. So that part feels really good.
Yeah. You used to write and draw and you had some other creative hobbies. And I'm curious where you find time for those or what those look like these days when you're trying to scale the business and father two young boys and have a marriage that works.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the story that you told that people tell you, you're going to lose all these things and you can't do these things. A lot of that's true. I mean, I don't think anybody should sugarcoat that for potential new parent. There is only so many hours in the day and only so much emotional energy and so only so much creative energy that you have. So for me, I would say the last 5 years, partially because of the business and partially having kids, neither one in isolation, I think is powerful enough to stop all the things that you love. But combined, that's pretty powerful. And so, yeah, writing poetry hasn't happened in a few years. I mean, I started this thing as a blogger. So writing and taking photos were a big part of my life, and I was good at both of them. I can't remember the last time I opened up Lightroom. I think it's been over a year. Even in my own business, which was basically founded on those two skill sets. I haven't written for the website, I think, in about a year. I used to be the only voice on it. Now I'm not even one of 40. And so the idea that I would read a book or write some poems or go to a life drawing class, which I used to love doing, like none of those things have happened in a long time. None of those feel like things I need to grieve in a permanent way. Some of those things have slowly started coming back into my life as I've started to understand the importance of them to my own health, and the effectiveness of feeling healthy has on being a good dad and being a good business owner. It's a very counterintuitive thing when you don't have any time to do anything. How do you put in more time towards a thing that doesn't seem productive, but ultimately makes you more productive? That's a hard thing. The closest I can relate that to is when you start working out, the first 2 weeks to a month suck. You're definitely not getting any residual benefit from that other than maybe dropping a few pounds. But on the backside of that, working out starts to return more energy to you than you seem to expend. But that's a very hard, virtuous cycle to get rolling. So I recognize the importance of those things in that kind of scenario, but it's been very hard to get them rolling. But I will say that most of that gets translated into what I do in ways I never would have expected. For example, you know, the ability I had to write a great line in a poem or succinctly capture a headline in something has translated to the way in which I now launch companies with a brand position. I'm able to put those six or seven words together in a way that is uncommonly good and effective. And I think that's what's made me good at what we do as a business. I'm able to show my writers and my designers and my other sort of marketing and communication folks what a good pitch looks like for a reason. And I can articulate it in a way that makes them more effective at doing it. And so a lot of those skills are getting translated into business building skills, which I think, you know, we underestimate the value of things like good writing, image making, and presenting them in a context that's exciting for people. I think we underestimate the value of those when we talk about building a business. But for me, that's required to build an uncommonly interesting or unique or successful business, at least in the context that I'm working in. So yeah, I guess most of that's been transferred to the business building in unique skills, in unique contexts. But I certainly see those things coming back into my life, surely but slowly, as I miss them more. They kind of have to come back for me to see value in doing this at all. Because if not, if all you ever get to do is the business, and the business isn't the thing in and of itself that brings you joy, then I'm not sure it has much purpose. Hopefully when I get to the other side of this like transitional role that I'm in, of letting go of some of the product management and letting go of the creative direction and settling into one role at the top of it all, building the business, some of that space and mental capacity will newly make room for those things again. I can tell you that when I do get those moments and I take advantage of them, it's just like getting on a bike. You don't lose the ability to do those things. You just have to, you know, you might be a little rusty, but I can still write a poem. I've written a couple and they're not horrible. So it's still there. It's just waiting. It feels like a big portion of who I am went into hibernation, but that's not who I am. It's just a thing that I enjoy doing. There's a lot of identity wrapped up in a lot of those things that's complicated. And I don't know.
You know, to be surprised by the fact that some of them just don't do it for you anymore and kind of chuckle about that.
It's okay.
Like,
that's okay.
This thing, I thought this was so important. Now I'm looking at it and it's like, I don't even want to do this. And then other things that you might have relegated, you know, to third, fourth, fifth priority, you're like, you know what? This thing, I'm going to like go deep into this random little obscure thing, you know? And,
right. Yeah. Who knows? Maybe I haven't even found the thing I like the most yet.
Right.
I mean, trying to discern between the things that you enjoy because of your circumstances and your context, between that and the things that make you who you are in an identity sense, are very difficult to tell apart sometimes because you're still in that context. I mean, 10 years from now, who knows if I'm still going to be running this business or any business in the way that I am now? And am I going to somehow mourn the loss of being able to be the entrepreneur and wish I had those days back? I don't know. So I definitely, as the way you described it, is like, just let it be for a minute. Don't take it as a permanent thing. Don't take it as like a, you know, a real loss. that's definitely a compartmentalization strategy I've had to learn starting a business and being a dad. That's like, man, just set it down. Don't let it distract you from doing the thing that you don't have a choice over doing anyway. Certainly don't let it like hold you back from enjoying what you're doing now and giving it your all. Unless I'm going to go do something with poetry and make it a thing and fight for the time, like I have to admit that thinking about it and being sad that I'm not doing it is not doing me any good.
Yeah, and it's not going to write the poem.
Right. 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, so go do the fucking thing. And when you get to the other side of it, take stock and see if you want to do it again.
Yeah.
That's fine. That's fine. It's okay for there to be seasons. And just tell yourself it's a season. Lie to yourself for as long as you got to. It's fine.
I've got one last question for you, sir. Does being a designer and maker and an artist and curator and these roles that you play, do they make you a better or worse dad?
I think it certainly makes me dad in a particular way. I think one of the things I'm really good at with my kids is paying attention to the nuances and patterns of what they're learning and how they're expressing themselves and how they're performing, and finding like these small moments to nudge them in a direction or to escalate something they're doing really quickly and, you know, help them see how cool and fun it could be. In that way, it's very much how I approach managing a creative team. Interdisciplinary skill set is like, I'm looking for the windows into what else those people can do, what else they're capable of, what else would make them excited. And I definitely bring that exact same mindset. It's the same feeling. It feels like I'm still doing the job when I come home, and I pay attention to my kids in a similar way, where I'm always just looking for that moment of insight that I can learn something new about them that they don't see about themselves yet. And then what can I do to just give them a window into that self-awareness, or what can I lay in their way that will disrupt them just the right way to get them to embrace something or explore it on their own? And so if there's anything I think that, you know, between this job and parenting, it would certainly be that. It would be the constant observation of the humanity around you in a way that you end up knowing them better than they know themselves, and then being able to do something with that.
I love this visual of you throwing a little something into the course of their race around the track that they have to steer around or collide with, or, you know, I'm imagining a Mario Kart, maybe it's a good thing and they scoop it up and they use it later. You know, that's something that you can't see racing around the track with them. You know, like your ability to do that comes from sort of being on the side of the track. And I love that idea. And
yeah, somebody needs to do it for me. I'm glad you called me.
Oh, man. It's an honor, Michael, to chat. And huge thank you to you for making the time and believing in this project. And
how the hell are you going to sit through so many of these? The emotional labor that you are, like, you're just absorbing so much energy right now. I don't know how you're going to handle this.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I need to go, like, sit in a room for 2 hours now.
I know.
Silently by myself. How are you going to just go do more of these? All the snot and tears and ugh. I think it speaks to the damage in our society that this is such a foreign thing to do, that the moment some of us get a chance, we just fucking spill our guts.
Yeah, right? It's crazy.
Yeah, I'm going to go home a little bit healthier for this today, that's for sure.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dadwell podcast. If you were inspired by what you heard, please take a few minutes to write a quick review on iTunes. As a first season podcast, this helps a ton and it would mean a lot to me. Dadwell is on Twitter, Instagram, Medium, and all the other relevant social networks. So visit dadwell.co to find links to all of them. While you're there, you can also subscribe to the Dadwell newsletter and even cop some fresh Dadwell merch. Additionally, you can support this project by becoming a patron via patreon.com/dadwell. That's patreon.com/dadwell. Thanks again for listening. My name is Antonio Garcia, and we'll talk again soon. Cheers.